Welcome back to Franchise Festival, where we go in-depth with the history, story, and gameplay of noteworthy video game series from the last 40 years. For Season 1, we're covering Nintendo's The Legend of Zelda. Last time, we covered The Wind Waker in Episodes 8 and 9, and this time we're onto a much smaller adventure in the Minish Cap. But first, let's introduce ourselves. We are your co-hosts, Christian.
And I'm Hamilton.
And I'm Spencer.
And we're really glad to have you with us today. I believe Hamilton has a question prompt for us to get started on sort of an off-topic matter so you can get to know us a little better. What you got for us, Hamilton?
So, Chris, I was thinking, since we're all talking about a podcast related to video games,
yeah,
and I assume that we've played many a video game in our day, I honestly was wondering, like, what brought us into video games in general? Like, what inspired us to play it? And continue to play them.
Yeah, it would be a little silly if we had not played any video games before recording a podcast on the subject, wouldn't it?
Right. Creative, sure, but...
avant-garde.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we learn as you learn.
Like, for instance, if I may start off.
Go for it.
So for me, and sorry, listeners, if it gets a little too personal, you guys can get your tissues out. It might be a sad story. But growing up... because I was a little, making friends a little tough for me growing up. I had a lot of complications kind of understanding social expectations, social norms. It was tough for me. I was not a natural born, kind of gregarious person. So video games kind of gave me that kind of release. One, because I enjoyed what I was seeing. From the visual spectacle, also being able to, like, keep my hands busy because I was a very, like, nervous habit kid. But also it kind of filled the void of some of the frustrations of not having social interaction. So at least that way I could kind of escape that frustration to a certain extent. Again, so sorry if I brought tears to all of your eyes.
No, I think
to go
like
the train.
I think a lot of folks have that in common. I don't think that's I don't think that's a sort of wild, out of left field kind of reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Now this actually I find intriguing because I just met you in college, Hamilton. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe a decade ago, and I would not have expected this. You know, you're such a naturally outgoing guy.
It's funny because. The people I went to middle school and high school with, when they saw me now for either during like high school reunions or things of that nature, they look at me blank-faced. They're just like, who are you?
Yeah, isn't that the way sometimes?
Yes, I've had people, many of my old classmates come up to me and just be like, is that really you, Hamilton? Like, I was like the Super Saiyan form of paint on the wall. Like, I never talked to anybody. I'd be hard-pressed to get two words out of me. Too shy to say anything. Just nervous about what people would say. Which, I mean, I still kind of am, but in a much different way.
Sure, yeah.
Suffice it to say, college, interestingly that you say that, had completely changed my social ability. If that's a phrase, for the rest of my life, I learned how to make friends there. I learned how to interact, how to study mannerisms and body language and kind of speak and just feel like I'm more myself, which is someone who I like cracking jokes. I like making people laugh, and it's just fun. So, like, and that's why I thought it was interesting to, like, what brought people into video games, because it could be something as simple as just, it's calming. Or sure. It's soothing. It's a break from the norm. Totally respect. Just for me, it had a very deep emotional connection to me personally. Which is why I thought it'd be interesting to kind of present that to the two of you. Like, what brought you into it? Again,
yeah, sure.
doesn't need to be super deep. Just curious.
How about you, Spencer?
Well, it's perhaps a bit less sentimental than Hamilton's. But,
Don't worry, mine is too.
Yeah, so my older brother, he's a good 24 years older than me. He had a Sega Genesis. And I remember one day my mom brought me over to his apartment after he got married. And he showed me the Sega Genesis and I played it. And at the time, I thought it was just the neatest thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
I loved it. And so in... Oh, I know what year the Sega Saturn came out. I guess I don't know what year David bought one, but he eventually bought a Sega Saturn, and when he did that, he mailed me his Sega Genesis, along with the two games he owned for it, Sonic the Hedgehog 2 and Virtua Fighter, because he also had a 32X.
Yeah.
And I just spent hours every day playing Sonic the Hedgehog 2. I couldn't get enough of it. And then from there, my love for video games just kind of kept growing and growing. Until in high school, I fell in with the PC gaming crowd.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then it's...
That's a specific niche.
Yes, it is.
So Spencer, if I might ask, it seems to me like you kind of fell in love with Sonic the Hedgehog. I feel this deep connection already. It makes it more sentimental to hear that.
Right, yeah, as we discussed last, that I do remember was our prompt last time. We got yes. somewhat into Sonic.
See, I knew we'd get along.
Uh-huh. You gotta love that blue blur.
Mm-hmm.
What about you, Chris?
Mine might be even more prosaic, because this is a question that I had never considered until I saw Hamilton write it down for the prompt today. If memory serves, my dad had an NES for some reason, and I say for some reason because he has no interest in video games whatsoever since I have been like a cognizant sentient, like like 8-year-old or more. But for some reason, when I was very young, he owned an NES, and I think he and my mother had played quite a bit of like Space Invaders and stuff. You know, they were of the right generation that they were into that in the arcades in the 70s and 80s. And so he owned an NES, and I watched him play Super Mario Brothers 3 and played it with him as a kid. And as far as I can tell, him playing Mario is my first memory of a game. From there, like, it's not very interesting. As time went on, I feel like, you know, my family kind of supported my hobby, but also, like, sort of discouraged it. You know, they weren't into that kind of thing. You know, I guess it was kind of a bonding element with me and friends. You know, friends and I played all the games. We had a Nintendo 64, and that was a great multiplayer system, so it was kind of the party thing. You know, there'd be a room with a Nintendo 64 in it. So I sort of fell out of it in college. And it's funny, when I went to visit a friend a few years ago and I was kind of back into the hobby, he said like, oh, I didn't know that you enjoyed video games. And I said, oh yeah, you know, it's one of my favorite hobbies. But because I met him in college, you know, it was something that he and I hadn't really shared. And so from like the end of high school through college, I wasn't too into it. And then, you know, post-college, it was the recession. So you know, like everybody else, I was just kind of scrounging around and certainly didn't have any real money to engage in the hobby. But ended up falling back in the 2010s, A, because I had a steady job and an income, and B, because this is very silly, but the Wii U, for one reason or another, was like my gateway back into the medium, as well as the website Gameological Society, which was an offshoot of the AV Club run by a man named John Teddy. And it exposed me to this world of non-toxic but thoughtful games discussion online that was similar to what I had experienced in college, talking with people about like movies, talking about books, and there was this whole world of like talking about games, you know, as kind of a respectable art form. And so that brought me kind of back in an intellectual way. And so that's really what kind of engaged me from the 2010s on is, you know, playing games and sort of thinking critically about them and how they appeal to me and how they tell stories and so forth. I am 100% as unfun at parties as I sound from this description. So yeah, let's get into the meat of this thing here with The Legend of Zelda: The Minish Cap. It was released in Japan on November 4th, 2004, in Europe on November 12th, 2004, and in North America on January 10th, 2005. Now, you know, close listeners might note that in contrast to virtually every Legend of Zelda game before this, that debuted in Europe before North America, because the Nintendo DS came out in North America in November 2004 and the European Union in March 2005.
So why did the DS being released earlier in North America lead to a later release date for a Game Boy Advance game?
So it had everything to do with kind of the commercial plans of Nintendo of America and Nintendo of Europe, which is to say that Nintendo of Europe didn't have a new piece of hardware to push, so they wanted to push the Minish Cap as their kind of their holiday tentpole release. You know, it was a new Legend of Zelda game. In North America, meanwhile, Nintendo of America's main commercial goal at the time was selling as many Nintendo DS units as they could. And so having the key piece of holiday hardware be on the platform that they were trying to move away from, the Game Boy Advance, was believed to have the potential to cut into Nintendo DS sales and reduce the likelihood of people picking up the new console. As far as staff, Minish Cap represents the last Legend of Zelda game that was developed as a collaboration between Nintendo and Capcom. So while it was overseen by Eiji Aonuma, the series producer, it was directed by Capcom's Hidemaro Fujibayashi. This was Fujibayashi's third time directing a Legend of Zelda game after the Oracle of Ages, the Oracle of Seasons, and the Game Boy Advance Four Swords, which was included alongside the Link to the Past port for the Game Boy Advance. And we're going to be talking a bit more about that Four Swords spinoff next time in Episode 11. After this, Fujibayashi would go on to become a full-time Nintendo employee and would have a pretty big hand in the creation of later Nintendo DS Zelda games. But we're going to get around to that in a few months.
I also noticed after I beat it that Iwata, Miyamoto, and Keiji Inafune all have producer credits on this game.
Ooh, now that's interesting. So Keiji Inafune was involved with this.
Interesting.
Mr. Mega Man himself. Very interesting. Yeah, I had no idea. With regard to the development process on this game, there were fewer resources to pull on than usual for researching it, because there has never been an Iwata Asks interview about this topic, which has been a really key source for some of our other episodes. Luckily, the Legend of Zelda Encyclopedia that was published in the West by Dark Horse Press has just a bit of information on how the Minish Cap got made, which we kind of combined together with some information from contemporary interviews to piece this narrative together. Development began as early as 2001, around the release of Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons, but was put on hold when Capcom and Nintendo began collaborating to create the aforementioned Four Swords, the multiplayer spin-off mode of the Game Boy Advance's Link to the Past. After that, development began again following the release of the Four Swords, and would make use of quite a few of the visual assets from Four Swords, which is kind of neat. Those are heavily informed by the visual style of the Wind Waker, but have their own kind of specific 2D flair that first appeared in the Four Swords, but would be pretty heavily expanded upon here in Minish Cap.
I definitely recommend that people like look up what the sprite work looks like on this game. Because with the limitations of the GBA, it's probably a little bit more difficult to bring out the individual characteristics of different people within the game. But when you see the sprite work in this game, it's actually quite remarkable when you see the individual actions of every different character, like, oh, this is the type of character that they are.
Yeah.
This is their personality. It's quite amazing.
In addition to the sprites just being, like, detailed and expressive, the animation.
There's so many frames of animation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's very good.
You can tell that they were using the Wind Waker as kind of the touchstone for this, because the Wind Waker was so expressive in a 3D space.
Mm-hmm.
And by golly, they stuck the landing on translating that to, like, a tiny pixelated screen. it would be reasonable for somebody who played this game and was familiar with the history of Nintendo to assume that somebody had the idea of a shrinking Link and decided to build the entire game around that. But the actual order of events is that at Capcom, some concept artists had created a miniature version of Link and a creature within a barrel. They'd created concept art of a corridor made out of gaps between oversized furniture. Really, these key concept arts are what inspired the entire production. One of the things that Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons would contribute to this process was Capcom feeling, or more specifically, Fujibayashi, feeling that they had been unable to effectively guide the player, and so they wanted to integrate a partner character in Minish Cap in much the same way that Navi had been in Ocarina of Time, or the King of Red Lions and Tetra had been in The Wind Waker. So what they did in this case was create the character of Ezlo. And we're going to talk about Ezlo down in the story section, but in short, Ezlo is a talking hat who accompanies Link on his adventure, and at the tap of a button can offer tips on where to go next. One of the other major influences on the Minish Cap were fairy tales and myths. So just a couple of examples of this. The Gust Jar tool was drawn directly from the Chinese novel Journey to the West. Journey to the West turns up in a lot of Japanese games. I was unfamiliar with the sort of Gust Jar's origin until researching this. But, like, it stands to reason that at some point Journey to the West would intersect with Legend of Zelda, doesn't it?
That makes so much sense.
Also, in Hyrule Town, there's a shoemaker who's aided by the little sort of diminutive Minish characters, the sort of small elves that can't be seen by humans. And that is drawn almost entirely from the German folktale The Elves and the Shoemaker, which appears in the 19th century Grimm's Fairy Tales book. And is a, you know, was a pretty popular folktale in Germany. Yeah, I had encountered it as a kid, and I thought it was funny when I encountered it in Minish Cap, and I thought, aha, you know, they're just, it's this fairy tale, right?
Mm-hmm. There's a few fairy tales, I believe, so I wish I had been more clear in my notes, but I made a reference to in Mount Krennel, to the Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, because I think there's seven Minish.
No way!
I wrote seven dwarves in my notebook. I have to assume that's what I meant.
Oh, sweet. Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't catch that either.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. The sort of folk tales and fairy tales and sort of classical literature exists as this kind of sort of odd informative palette for Minish Cap. And certainly we've just cited three examples here, but I'm sure there are others in the game. For Hyrule Town in this, the team had focused on designing a more complex hub area than had been present in any earlier 2D or 3D Zelda game, with the result that the central town in this, Hyrule Town, takes on kind of the sort of a low-key format of a dungeon. There aren't enemies, but there are areas of the town that are inaccessible at the first point that you visit it, and then you slowly unlock them as you gain new tools and abilities throughout the game.
Yeah.
A quick aside here, since we're talking about unlocking stuff in Hyrule Town.
Sure.
I got that stupid ghost to move from Anju's house and went inside as a Minish. I got attacked by baby chickens, made it to the roof, and talked to the cuckoo up there, and all it said was something about how, I don't know, it's a cuckoo on the roof. Like, I could not find any rhyme or reason to why that's there, or what I was supposed to gain from getting the ghost and getting inside. Did either of you find anything?
I admit I did not even go that far.
I didn't know that you could move the ghost, and now feel super vindicated for not having bothered.
I feel like there's gotta be something, but I couldn't figure it out for the life of me.
That could be just something they just didn't expand on, but they meant to, maybe.
It's possible. Like, Capcom runs a tight ship, you know, so, and I guess, you know, now is as good a time to address this as any. But the Minish Cap is a rare example of a Legend of Zelda game where there is post-game content.
Mm-hmm.
You can save your game at the end of the credits, which I did. You know, I just finished the game last night, so I didn't really have any time to you know, get into the post-game. However, I looked into it, and if you start the game back up after you've saved, it does sort of the classic Zelda thing of starting you out just before the final confrontation, But there are additional things that you can unlock in the world. In particular, I recall there are some Gorons who are digging a tunnel. You can't actually finish that quest until you go back into the game after having completed it.
That's good to know. It was driving me nuts that I couldn't find the other Gorons.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because I only found
also
two
the
of them.
The Vati figurine. Apparently, there's a final form Vati that you can only get after you've seen the final form, which means you would have had to beat the boss.
Yeah, I want to say there's six figurines, and we'll address this down in the gameplay section. But figurines are one of the collectibles in this game, and there are a handful of figurines that are only accessible when you return to it after having defeated the final boss. Hamilton, did you want to take us through the story of this game?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Now, unlike some of the previous installments that we've had, the story's not too in-depth in this one. In fact, it's basically just collect the MacGuffins and win the day.
Yeah.
But I'll go into the story as much as I can. Especially in the sense that there's a returning villain from a previous game, Four Swords.
Not a game that we covered. Yeah, this is kind of a weird case where it's a returning villain, but not one who's appeared on our show. Just due to how we've structured this with regard to like spin-offs. And, you know, just a quick note for listeners, Four Swords came out in 2002, and then Four Swords Adventure for the GameCube, which also featured Vati, came out a few years later. So the Minish Cap is actually the third video game that features Vati. Very strange.
To kind of start us off, so in this installment of Legend of Zelda, we get the land of Hyrule that had been cast into the shadows by evil spirits. Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
And liberated by beings called the Picori. Much apologies if I'm mispronouncing that. The Picori are also the Minish, but we'll see more of that later. Legend has it the Picori came from the sky, and they bestowed light to the land in the form of the Golden Life Light Force, sorry, and the Picori Blade.
Yeah.
The Hero of Men, as he was called, which, yeah, you can probably guess who the hero is. They show it in, like, a kind of glass pane.
Yeah, it's like a stained glass, like, still frame cutscene at the beginning.
Still frame cutscene, but it's clearly Link. The Hero of Men used the two powers, along with his wisdom and courage, to defeat the evil and restore the world to peace. Thus, the yearly Picori Festival was made to honor the Picori who came down. Not so much the hero, from what I understand, which is very interesting. However, over time, the Picori passed into legend, to the point where people didn't really see them anymore, or even question their existence. Thus, they became the Minish instead of Picori, though they still keep the name Picori for the festival and the blade, but we'll talk about that in a second. There was also another legend, telling of a doorway that'll open every 100 years, which will allow the Picori / Minish to enter the world again.
Hmm.
Which leads nicely into our story, because what a coinkydink, our game takes place 100 years after the Picori saved the world. And it opens with our favorite hero from every Legend of Zelda game, a child form of Link, who's being awoken by his closest friend, Princess Zelda. So in this game, he's already met Zelda. They've already been acquainted. They know each other. They're childhood friends.
Yeah, I think this is just worthy of dwelling on for just a moment, is I think this is the only Legend of Zelda game where Link and Zelda are kind of buddies from the beginning. Like, Link knows Zelda in the context of Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons, in that he has already had some kind of adventure in Hyrule. But in this case, he has not had an adventure before. This version of Link just happens to be friends with the princess, which is kind of a neat twist. That's not something that was the case in any earlier Zelda game.
It is, because in this game, so they're supposed to attend a festival where Link, at the behest of his grandfather and blacksmith named Smith,
His parents knew what he was going to do.
From the moment he was born, his destiny was written in stone. He should be the hero. But in either case, Smith created a blade for the champion of a sword fighting tournament that was taking place during the festival. Which, going back to what you were saying before, Chris, it's not really specified, I don't believe, unless I'm completely wrong. But I think that, like, Smith has made blades for the royal family in the past.
That's definitely implied.
I think that's implied, so maybe that's how Link and Zelda kind of met. And, like,
yeah,
maybe that's how they grew
makes
up.
Sense.
But again, that's me stretching. I don't think they ever actually said that, but it would make sense.
Yeah.
Well, I think they said that traditionally Smith makes the sword that's presented to the winner of the festival every year.
Mm. Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm. So Princess Zelda's very excited about attending the festival. So they go and they check the festival out very quickly, but Princess Zelda has to return to the castle because she is, after all, a princess who has her own duties.
This scene where Link and Zelda are attending the festival together gave me real Chrono Trigger vibes.
I was just about to say that!
Yeah.
It's straight out of Chrono Trigger.
It's straight out of Chrono Trigger.
It is straight out of the game.
Yeah.
There's even a bell there!
Yeah. Like, it's wild. It's like they pulled in Chrono Trigger to a Legend of Zelda game. Like, even down to it being a princess that you're accompanying.
Yes. It's like, what's another great game? Chrono Trigger? Yeah, let's do that. That'll draw everybody in. But everything is not all fun and games this time around, however, because the champion named Vati eventually shows himself. Vati almost seemed to have won the tournament, swordsmanship tournament, almost by magic, to the point where people were like spreading rumors, just like, wow. Can he really be this strong?
Yeah.
Well, we do find a little bit more about Vati, because as we return the prince to the castle and try to present Link's grandfather's sword to him, Vati actually subdues the guards, destroys the Bakori sword, which is a very prominent, you know, item in the world.
Yeah, it's almost like a monument, yeah.
Exactly. And opens up the box underneath it, which unleashes basically all the monsters into the world. The world, I think, was more or less at peace.
Yeah, just another sort of odd first for the Zelda series. As far as I recall, this is the first Legend of Zelda game that justifies there being monsters wandering around the world.
Yeah.
As they come out of this box.
Which opens up another story, basically Pandora's box. He opens it.
Oh my goodness.
And chaos reigns.
Good call.
Mm-hmm.
Another myth.
But, also kind of like the myth, he was expecting a treasure within the box. Mm-hmm. He didn't expect the monsters to come out. Not that he really cares, mind you. But there was something he was searching for, which is a light force, but he doesn't really explain what he was looking for until a little bit later in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So he sits there, kind of chuckles, and then turns Zelda into stone, and then leaves. Which brings about your task. Now you need to unbreak that curse. And this is the part where the Minish Cap's story honestly kind of goes a little bit, not south. It's a fine story for a Legend of Zelda Game Boy Advance game, but it gets very kind of basic.
Yeah, like from here you need to collect the parts.
Exactly. This is where the MacGuffin parts really comes into play. In the sense that when you... So the first thing you do is that you visit the Minish Woods, which has an awesome soundtrack, by the way.
Yeah.
I didn't like it at first, but it grew on me.
We'll dub it in here.
Bam. But when he enters the Minish Woods, he rescues a talking cat by the name of Ezlo. Ezlo is a Minish, so he's a race of the Bakori that vanished into legend, and he was actually once Vati's teacher.
Yeah.
He actually created something called the Mage's Cap, which is supposed to be a gift to humans for when the 100-year door actually opens. However, his student, Vati, became a little obsessed with... I believe they said he became obsessed with the evil within man, and also wanted to obtain ultimate power. Which is interesting, because I thought that they were really going somewhere in an interesting way, for the first part of that sentence. And again, as listeners probably know, I'm very interested in stories. So when I read up on characters and just like, he's very interested in the evils of man, it's like, of course I'm going to go on a tangent and be like, why? Did someone do something?
Like, it makes me wonder if there's more in Four Swords Adventure. Like, I doubt there is. That's a pretty, multiplayer straight putt, but maybe there's more to Vati's story there. I don't know.
Exactly. Did he witness evil?
Yeah.
But just for the sake of simplicity, we'll just say that he won ultimate power, which again is what he wanted. So he puts the cap on himself, and he becomes a very, very powerful wizard. And the first thing that he does is that he curses his teacher, Eslo, which becomes a magic talking cap. So what Eslo does to join you on your adventure is that he lands himself on top of your head and becomes your cap. Thus, you become the full Link that you're probably used to playing as by now.
The animation where Eslo climbs Link and affixes himself to the top of Link's head is one of my favorite animations in the game. it looks a lot like a facehugger from Alien.
Yes.
He hurls himself onto Link's face, and Link, tries to pull him off, and Eslo, grafts himself onto the top of Link's head.
There's a really cute little bit to their relationship too. Whenever you sleep at the inn, or I think there's other places you can sleep as well, Link and the Hat share a bed.
Oh, and cute.
It's really cute. It's really cute the way Link wakes up and then kind of shakes the Hat awake, and that kind of blinks bleary eyed at Link for a little while before he shuffles back up on there.
I never saw that. I didn't know that you could sleep anywhere in the game. That's a great touch.
Yeah, that it's really adorable.
Yeah, there is an inn in Hyrule Town where you can sleep.
Yeah.
And Ezio kind of joins you on your quest. He gives you advice, but also kind of teases and jokes with you as well.
Yeah.
Kind of like an old friend. You get close very quickly. It's very Tettle and Link.
Yes, yeah. It feels much closer to that than Navi.
Yes. Where Ezio is not shy about being like, oh, I wasn't scared of that, were you? Haha, you probably were. Mm-hmm. Not me. Type situation. He also has a very interesting ability, which leads to actually one of the most important abilities in the game, which is shrinking you to the size of a Minish.
Yeah.
Now Link is tasked with reforging the Picori Blade by King Daltus, Princess Zelda's father. From here, it's basically this, it is the MacGuffin quest.
Yeah, it's very gameplay focused. It's, go to point A, go to point B, go to point C in order to accomplish the quest.
Exactly. The quest being that you need to collect the four elements, which is the embodiment of power of fire, earth, water, and wind. In this time, Vati actually possesses King Daltus and orders his soldiers to look for the Light Force.
Real quick, before we address that, just one sort of odd, again, kind of an odd detail for a Zelda game that I wanted to note. Mm-hmm. This is a very rare example of Hyrule Castle being full of friendly NPCs. And being able to just go around and explore Hyrule Castle for the first half of the game. Mm-hmm. And talk to the king and talk to the king's minister. And it's sort of interesting in that Hyrule Castle is kind of a base of operations for the player, as opposed to a hostile place, as it tends to be in other Zelda games, because it's already been taken over at their start. But of course, that all ends halfway through the game.
Exactly. Halfway through the game, Daltus gets possessed by Vati, as previously mentioned. And from there, that's when the guards become quote-unquote hostile. Vati does find out that you're collecting the elements as well, but also learns that combining the four elements will open up the path that he's looking for. So he basically is just like, whatever, I'll just let Link do his own thing. Very a la Ocarina of Time that Ganondorf did.
He does what Ganondorf does in Ocarina of Time and Wind Waker. It's very much a Zelda trope at this point, yeah.
So once you collect the four elements, and the path of the Force opens up to you, you actually learn that Princess Zelda has a life force, light force, inside her. In fact, the light force has actually been passed down from royal princess to princess throughout the generations. So Vati knocks you out and hopes to draw out the light force within Zelda. It doesn't completely succeed, but draws out enough power where he poses a good final battle fight for you.
Yeah, he does sort of a Resident Evil style transformation into, like, you know, multiple ascending levels of demonic figure.
Exactly. He kind of taps into his own powers of darkness as well as the limited powers of light that he got.
Right.
And fights you. You win, hopefully, if you're playing the game.
After enough game overs, Link succeeds.
After enough game overs, he eventually succeeds. Thankfully, Vati's very patient. He's willing to let you revive as many times you need to. And Zelda uses this, uses the Mage's Cap and the Light Force to wish all the cruelty that Vati unleashed into the world to be undone, which causes a lot of miracles to happen.
Yeah.
And Ezreal himself, now with the curse broken, he enters through the Minish door. Maybe in 100 years or so he'll return once the door opens again.
He bestows like a version of the cap on Link when he leaves.
Yeah, and says, like, this suits you.
Yeah, it's a real stretch as an origin story for Link's hat.
Yeah. So I know that Chris wanted to go into some interesting characters. I was just going to touch on some interesting characters that I saw really fast, if that's okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot. There are a ton of characterized NPCs in this game.
One thing that I thought was very, very cool was that Naryu, Din, and Furore actually show up in this game. And they show up from Oracle of Seasons and Oracle of Ages.
Yeah, this is so cool.
Mm-hmm.
They pop up in the inn in Hyrule Town.
Mm-hmm. And in this game, they do retain their previous story in the sense that Din's a famous dancer and Naryu is a famous singer. But in this game, they don't have the powers they did before, as in, like, Din is not the the Oracle of Seasons.
Yeah.
Naryu is not the Oracle of Ages. But they're all looking for a house. And Furore is actually a character from the Linked Together part of the two Oracle series. And she kind of delves into more of the secrets that happen when you connect the two games. So it was very interesting to me that they all three of them showed up in this game as well. There's two more characters that I'll mention, and I'll let Chris, I think, chime in, because I think there's some characters I definitely missed, and I'm sure I did. But the Blade family is in this game, and they teach you various combat techniques, and I believe this is the only game that they show up in. But I like to, I think because it's a common theme at this point, that Link always has some kind of teacher. Other than that, they don't really have much personalities. I think you learn from, like, a ghost for one of them, but for the most part, you when you learn technique, you get Tiger Scrolls. And yeah. The more Tiger Scrolls you have, you can learn from different masters, which teach you fancier techniques.
Yeah, like firing off a blast from the sword when you're at full health or at one health, or doing the spin attack.
Exactly. Some of it's super handy. Some of it, I admit, I didn't go too far into. The last character, however, is one that's been recurring many, many times throughout our series. It's Tingle. Tingle is in this game.
I have to admit, I somehow completely missed Tingle in the playthrough of this.
I'm the same, Spencer. I didn't encounter Tingle. I thought he wasn't in this.
I will fully admit that I was just curious if he'd be in this game, because it seemed weird if he wasn't.
Yeah.
Especially since, like, there's Child Link in here. So I did a little bit of digging, and I found out that he is indeed... He and his siblings.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. He actually wants you... The first thing that you do is connect your kinstones with him. And again, if you're wondering what a kinstone is, we'll cover that later. But he wants you to connect kinstones, which you do. And then he's like, I want you to find the same with my siblings. And I think you have to find, like, 100 kinstones and connect it. And then you get, like, unlockables. By the way, this has no relevance to the story whatsoever. So if you're the type that just kind of wants to play the game to play the game, none of this is necessary. That's why you can very easily, and I didn't as well, I didn't see him. I wanted to note it, because that's, like, one of our things we do. It's just like, yes, but is Tingle in the game, though?
Exactly. It's the question that everybody's asking. You know, whenever Tingle's not on screen, everybody should be asking, where's Tingle?
Exactly. So just letting you know, so you can breathe a sigh of relief, folks, he's in this game. But Chris, Spencer, is there anything that you would like to note in terms of interesting characters? Or story, whatever I missed.
Well, my personal favorite is the shitty mayor.
Yeah, how did he get elected?
Right?
Yeah, he sits around doing nothing, and when you talk to him, he says something along the lines of, "The town's doing great, and I haven't done anything. Imagine how great it would be if I actually did my job."
Right.
And he's got his, like, his little villa over on Lake Hylia.
Yeah.
Yeah, good call. I didn't pay too much attention to the mayor, but he is pretty silly. One thing that I noted about this is that there are a few characters kind of pulled from the 3D Zelda games. The ranch folks, this is the first appearance of, and if memory serves, the only appearance of Lon Lon Ranch in a 2D Zelda game. And so consequently the kind of Mario stand-in is there. What's his name?
I think it's
I don't remember.
Talon?
Talon and Malon. Yeah.
As well as the kind of Luigi stand-in from Majora's Mask also makes an appearance in Hyrule Town, though he seems to be disconnected with Lon Lon Ranch in this game.
Yeah, he's not part of the brothers anymore, is he?
Ingo, I think.
Ingo,
right?
That's it. Yep.
Ocarina of Time he's into.
Yes, exactly. Ingo appears here and sort of he comes in and has a house in Hyrule Town.
Orca's older brother from Wind Waker appears in the library.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
That's pretty wild.
Kind of the big-headed scholar character from Wind Waker.
Yeah.
Interesting.
There's a sprite in here.
I didn't even notice that, yeah. In a really odd twist, the business scrub from Majora's Mask turns up in this game.
Yeah.
And then, finally, the Zora do not appear in this whatsoever. Which I thought was kind of a bummer and sort of an odd omission. The Gorons are here, but the Zora are not. All right, Spencer, did you want to walk us through the gameplay of this game?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the first one we're covering for the show, at least, that was on the Game Boy Advance. So that gives us the addition of shoulder buttons.
Yep.
The R button in this case is bound to a like a combat roll.
Yeah.
Which is kind of spectacular. That roll is very fast. You can navigate the world pretty quickly with that. In fact, there were, I don't know if this is intentional, there were certain puzzles that I think were designed to have you use the Pegasus boots to move through, but I didn't need the Pegasus boots. You move fast enough by spamming the roll to get through them.
The roll in this takes on a roll, if you will, very similar to roles in later, much more technically oriented action-adventure games. Things like Dark Souls or Sparklight, to name a recent indie game, where rolling can get you through enemy attacks. So I found you can actually roll through the sort of fire wands that spin around and are intended to sort of route you into certain areas. You can just roll through them.
Yeah, so it's a good roll. There's, as we mentioned before, there are quite a few collectibles that you can get in this game.
Yeah.
The most important of which probably being the Kin Stones. These are objects you find throughout the game. Sometimes they are the product of exploration or solving an optional puzzle. Some of them just drop from bushes. Mm-hmm. These come in various colors and shapes. If you see an NPC with a think bubble above their head, you can press left shoulder and it brings up a menu where they have half of a kinstone, and you scroll through the ones you have to match it with them.
Yeah.
And when you match kinstones with an NPC, that will unlock chests, new areas. Oftentimes this will lead to rupees, heart containers. Sometimes it'll unlock fairy fountains, great fairy fountains. There's quite a lot that they can unlock from this. I like this mechanic quite a bit. I don't have a concrete source on this, but I believe the color is tied to rarity. There's green, which are the most common, and then blue, and then red.
Yeah.
Two 3 points actually throughout the game. You find gold kinstones, and those are used as actually part of the plot. You combine those with something in order to move the main story forward. Mm-hmm. Of note, though, with the kinstones, if you match kinstones with one of the three goddesses we mentioned before, Nehru, Din, or Feror, those will unlock joy butterflies. Those are little butterflies somewhere throughout the world that when you find them, they will upgrade the speed of your swimming, the shooting of your arrow, or the digging with the mole mitts.
Yeah, that's cool. I never did this.
Yeah, these are pretty... I thought they were pretty meaningful upgrades. They're just quality of life changes.
Yeah.
But at some points throughout the game, the digging especially feels painfully slow. So that was a nice upgrade to have.
Yeah, I wish I'd have found these.
And then the most useless collectible are the mystery shells.
Oh, yeah.
These are everywhere. You find them in chests, secret areas, they drop from bushes, and you can spend them to unlock figurines. It's kind of a gambling system. When you pay the man the mystery shells, he will give you a percent chance to unlock a figurine that you have not gotten before.
Yeah.
The more figurines you have, the more shells you have to give him to kind of up that percentage. As far as I know, there is no real correlation between figurines and other upgrades. It is just kind of a fun thing to get.
Yeah, that's my understanding of it, is it's pretty typical for, like, portable games of the era, in that Pokemon had kind of inspired this collectathon mechanic in handheld games in the right around the turn of the century. And so it stands to reason that there would be some kind of long-term collectible in the newest Zelda game in the early 2000s. How about tools in this game, Spencer?
Yeah, so we got a couple interesting new ones. I only listed the new ones here,
yeah.
But we do have some classics that return. You know, your bow, your boomerang, bombs, Pegasus boots.
Just a quick note, the boomerang, hilariously, you just buy at the shop in town, which I thought was kind of cute.
Yep.
So the first one you obtain is the Minish Cap.
Ezlo
himself. This can be activated when standing on certain platforms to shrink Link. This allows the player to navigate otherwise impassable terrain, as well as speak with animals. So the ability to kind of change state between shrunk and not shrunk at specific locations isn't a new concept to the series. It's a little less ambitious, in my opinion, than in the past. Because, you know, Oracle of Ages and Link to the Past, you have essentially entire new overworlds that you can navigate. In this case, it's still just the same overworld. You can just squeeze into kind of more narrow passages than when you're in your larger self.
It's less ambitious in that there is not an entire second world to explore, but it's more ambitious in that many of the environments in Minish Cap need to accommodate both standard size Link and small Link. And so it's kind of like two worlds overlaid directly on top of each other, which I think is kind of a different design challenge that I thought they stuck the landing on.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out, because I did notice, back to when you're in Minish form in Hyrule Town, I noticed quite a lot of care did go into making sure you cannot navigate to where you're not supposed to before you've unlocked certain things as a Minish.
Mm-hmm.
There's little things like little raised areas. And
we can enter houses, anything. Mm-hmm. It's also kind of interesting, too, that like just how much of a part the Minish play in people's everyday lives.
Yes. Unseen.
Unseen, because like as you talk to various people amongst Hyrule Town, they're going to say, like, I don't know where this thing went. Or, you know, I don't know how this thing keeps getting finished. Or all this kind of stuff. What a miraculous thing. Then inevitably you get smaller, and then you realize, like, behind the scenes, the Minish are actually doing quite a lot of things. So I thought that was an interesting touch as well.
Yeah, they're like, their little houses are surrounding humans at all times. Some of them are a little obvious. You know, there's a little Minish house just kind of on the west side of Hyrule Town, but then other ones are like a little mouse hole, or one of the best ones is the rafters over the
over the library.
Oh, it's the library
or the cafe.
It?
Yeah.
It's one of the town buildings. Yeah,
I think there's a couple buildings where you've got Minish in the rafters above the cafe, the bakery.
Yeah, it's a really nice visual trick too, with kind of the parallax scrolling, like oversized version of the environment you'd normally be exploring in standard size, but it's like it's underneath you and you're tiny and on the rafters above it. It's a really neat visual trick.
In general, when you go to a Minish specific area, the sprite work is very good.
Yeah.
Moving on to the first dungeon item you get, the Gust Jar. As far as I know, this is the first time this has appeared in a Zelda game.
It is.
It allows the player to suck in and shoot out air. This is utilized to grab objects from afar, put out fires, remove and like suck armor off of particular enemies. It allows you to vacuum up dust, spider webs, and it allows you to propel floating platforms and lily pads, similar to the Deku Leaf and Wind Waker. You point kind of the opposite direction you want to go, and you just shoot out puffs of air to go to propel yourself the opposite direction. The item from the second dungeon is the Cane of Pachi.
Yeah.
This shoots a projectile that flips objects over, and also, curiously, can be shot at a hole in the ground that allows Link to be shot up in the air.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This item can also be used to kind of flip over enemies and expose weaknesses. Most notably, you know, obviously turtle type enemies.
Right. Yeah. Those spinies and all.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. This really bugged me because I got hung up in the mid game because you need to flip over jars in town that allow you to transform into a Minish form using the Cane of Pachi. The game does not at any point teach you this, and Ezlo will not hint towards it if you tap the select button, which is the get hint from Ezlo button.
You know, I discovered that completely on accident, and do you know how?
How?
So, because when you jump, you can jump in holes without shooting it, and Link just kind of hunkers down in the hole. The same thing with the jars. When you go up to them, Link will kind of like jump in and sit in them. And I was thinking in my head, oh, if I shoot the Cane of Pachi at one of these jars, can I then use the jar to shoot me up someplace like I can a hole in the ground? Mm-hmm. So then I shot the jar with the cane, and then it flipped over into a Minish transform point. And I was like, oh, okay.
I'll bet that's how you're supposed to discover it, and I just kind of goobered my way through it. I just, you know, I never made that mental connection.
I didn't either. I literally kind of Googled my way through
it. Right, yeah, I had to look it up. Yeah,
I was like, I don't know what to do.
I mean, I don't know. I felt like I looked my way into it, too. It seems like a little bit of a reach to think that they wanted the players to think that way to find it out, but I don't know. Moving on, though, to the next item. In my opinion, one of the least interesting ones, the Mole Mitts.
They're visually cool.
They are visually cool, but in this is the Wind Fortress, I think, you get these items. As you navigate that dungeon, there's just big mounds of dirt walls blocking a lot of items and paths. When you get the Mole Mitts, they're just digging claws that allow you to kind of dig your way through the dirt. After you finish that same dungeon, though, the Wind Fortress, you get the Ocarina of Wind, which is your fast travel tool.
Ah, so good.
Yeah.
Then you also have the Flame Lantern. Lights up dark rooms, burns cobwebs, melts ice, lights torches. There looks like you noted, Chris, that you can use this to transform Gibdos into Stalfos, which I did not know.
Oh, that's funny. The Gibdos just wrecked me in this game. They take a huge chunk of your health bar when they kind of give you a bear hug. And if you're quick with the Flame Lantern, you can kind of circle around them and burn them, and then they turn into an enemy that just takes two hits to beat and barely damages you.
Interesting.
The Gibdos definitely kicked my ass at first, too, until I realized the boomerang basically stuns them forever.
That's true, yeah. Once I learned the boomerang, I stopped using the Flame Lantern.
I just spammed attack. Hope for the best.
Whatever works. Let's walk through some of the noteworthy enemies and bosses in this game.
Well, my personal favorite are the Rupee Likes.
Yeah.
Really, I hated those bastards.
Well, they sucked, but in terms of design, I thought they were really interesting. So these are Likes that kind of have a rupee dangling from a tentacle like an anglerfish. Yeah. If you just see a rupee lying on the ground, you need to be careful because when you get close to it, they will spring up from the ground and kind of eat you. Instead of taking your shield, or like in pass games, they will eat your rupees, and they mm-hmm. eat rupees in increments of whatever a rupee is showing from their tentacle.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
I lost hundreds of rupees because I got stuck in an unfortunate spot where basically a red rupee like ate me where it was blocked on three sides.
Wow.
Mm. So it was eating rupees 20 at a time. And as you kind of move to break free, you kind of move your D-pad around. Whatever direction you're facing when you finally break free is the direction it shoots you in. But if that direction is blocked, it just kind of shoots you straight up in the air and it re-eats you. And I could not find a rhyme or reason to the timing or number of button inputs or anything to kind of purposefully point myself in the one direction that I needed to be in when it released me. So it just kept popping me out facing the wrong direction and getting re-eaten over and over and over again.
I like that their rupee is sometimes hidden among actual rupees.
That caught me so many times. More times than I care to admit.
Yeah, they really adapted to their environments. They're a truly Darwinian Zelda enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Also worth noting, there are some Mario enemies that make an appearance.
There sure are, yeah.
Chain Chomp mm-hmm. sadly does not come back, a la Link's Awakening.
Yeah.
But we do get Bomboms and Lakitus.
Yep.
Before I start going through like bosses, do either of you have a favorite enemy from here that you'd like to draw attention to?
I mean, all the enemies are pretty standard. I did find it kind of interesting that to defeat the enemies, you really have to make use of the various weapons that you get.
Yeah.
And maybe this is just my memory failing me, but I don't remember like you having to be quite as versatile with your weapons in previous games. Like in this one, there are definitely enemies where you have to use the staff to beat.
Yeah.
You have to use the gust jar to beat. And I thought that was kind of an interesting way to like make items relevant.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I would say that the enemy variety in this is just heads above any earlier 2D Zelda game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they bring back quite a few old enemies. They bring in enemies from the Mario series. They redesign quite a few enemies. And, of course, there are quite a few new ones. There are these moles that pop up out of the ground in towers that are pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I like the enemy design when you're in Minish form, because generally yes. it's not tiny monsters. It's just things like slugs and insects. In some cases, they're used as bosses, but you just run into like the normal enemies Link would face, but they are giant.
It's very a la Yoshi's Story.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. Yeah, just standard enemies made giant.
Mm-hmm.
The first boss you run into is the giant green choo-choo. This is just, you know, this is encountered in a Minish dungeon, so this is just a standard green choo, but it is significantly larger than you here.
Yeah.
The design's kind of cool. You use the gust jar on this. You kind of draw, use the gust jar to draw slime away from its base to make it unstable, eventually crashing and falling over, at which point you can damage it with your sword.
Yeah, it's so cute.
It is.
The second boss you face is Gleerock, which is kind of a variation of the classic Zelda boss Gleok.
Yeah.
This is kind mm-hmm. of like a turtle dragon looking thing. I just wanted to note the boss arena itself is a throwback to the King Dodongo arena in Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, I noticed that. That was neat.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, it's just a little ring with a big hole in the middle, and if you look down through the hole, you see just a pit of lava, and then you drop down, and it's just another basically square arena with a lava pool in the middle.
Yeah, it's pretty cool that they replicated that in 2D.
So the way you beat Gleerock, well, first, Gleerock's main attack is that he will spit fire at you, leaving flames behind in the movable area that you have to either avoid or extinguish. The gust jar I found was the most efficient tool for that. He'll also submerge and cause rocks to fall from the ceiling and the lava pool to kind of expand outward. You defeat him by hitting his body with the cane of Pachi to flip it over and then running across his mm-hmm. neck to get to his underside and attack him with the sword there.
And that's where I got hit a lot.
Really?
I don't know if it's just me or whether I was just losing my mind, but if I was a pixel off, I went straight into the lava every single time I tried to run across this guy's neck.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't run into that trouble, but I could see it.
So when you hit him, basically how it works is that when a shell hits the body, his neck falls down the ground, and he's going to be pointing either up, down, left, or right. From there, you make your way across his neck, and you attack his vulnerable underside. But for me, the problem I ran into is that it might just been the game that I was playing. I was on the Wii U. I don't know if this would make any difference or not. But I was, again, like a pixel or just a toe off. I ran to the lava so many times to the point where I literally had to crawl on my hands and knees to, like, get across his neck and attack.
Yeah, that sounds, like, super sensitive. I didn't encounter that, but I've encountered that in other Zelda games, so I know what you're talking about.
Next, we've got Mazal. He kind of reminds me of Omek from Legends of the Hidden Temple.
Oh, yeah.
But it's floating head and fists. You need to use the bow to kind of shoot the palms of the hands when they're not attacking you to incapacitate them, and then hit them with the sword to fully knock them out. Once both hands are incapacitated, you can use a platform to go to shrink, enter the head, and then attack pillars to damage the boss. At certain thresholds, the boss head will fill with dirt, and you just need to dig through that with the mole mitts to get to the pillar to damage it. The main attack, at least that I saw with this boss, was that he just kind of balls his hands into fists and tries to slam them down on you.
Right, yeah.
He can also summon beetles, which try to slow you down and shoot a laser that will shrink you.
Yes.
Not to brag, I didn't run into this, because I found as soon as I left the head, he typically would default one hand into the fist attack.
Yeah.
At which point I could just immediately hit the other hand with an arrow.
I did get hit with the shrinking laser once. And it's a pretty funny, you know, it really sort of makes you alarmed because you're like, oh my goodness, yeah, he's going to squish me. And so you have to get back to normal size really quick. You sort of wish maybe it would get annoying, but it's such an alarming thing when it happens the first time that it's pretty neat.
Yeah, and the beetles aren't particularly that annoying, really, because he does slam his fist down and then beetles fall from the ceiling and they just kind of come and get you. But they don't do any damage, and they take a very quick, sword swipe.
Yeah.
So that's not as annoying as a laser, I would say.
I will go to bat for Mazal as one of the best 2D Zelda bosses.
Mm-hmm.
I adore this boss fight. It makes use of, like, three or four different tools. It makes use of both the standard size and Minish size. It's really, like... Mm-hmm. It's a whole bunch of game mechanics combined into a single fight that's mercifully not so hard that you have to play it a bunch of times.
It is a very multifaceted fight. And, I mean, when you first walk into the boss room, you see whatever it is. The place where you go to get smaller.
Right.
So you kind of like figure at some point in this fight, I have to go to Minish size to beat him.
Yeah, pretty cool.
We got ourselves the big Octorok. So this is another Minish Temple boss, so giant version of a normal enemy. It's frozen alongside the water element that you need, and when you open up the roof to let sun in, it unfreezes the element, but unfreezes the Octorok as well, who eats it and then runs away into the boss arena.
Yeah.
I believe when you first get in there, it's not frozen over. It's just the Octorok in his thawed form, who spits rocks at you that you have to deflect back at it. After you deflect enough at it, it will kind of freeze the arena over and freeze itself, and it's got like a weird plant tail.
Yeah.
In this phase, you have to kind of run around it and get it to kind of circle after you, stop and change directions. Because the floor is frozen, its momentum will kind of keep it turning, and as you run the opposite direction, then you can reach its tail with the flame lantern, light that on fire, which then kind of lights up along the tail like a fuse and unfreezes the boss and kind of thaws the arena out, and then you rinse repeat.
I stumbled my way through this fight. I never realized that its momentum would continue as I changed direction, and so I found this boss hopelessly finicky and died about three times trying to figure out how to get behind it.
I had the same problem. Just because I just kept going in a circle and a circle and a circle, and I just kept matching it, and I was just like, haha, this sucks.
Even with knowing that, it still felt finicky. I had a similar problem, I guess, to Hamilton had on Gleerock, where even when I feel like I executed it right, you still have to move pretty darn quick to get around to its tail, and I found myself constantly just clipping its hind leg on my way to it, and then getting hurt and not quite getting there in time.
Just a quick note on the dungeon lead up that leads to the big Octorok. I thought this was one of the cooler inversions of the game, in that in the Temple of Droplets, you actually access the boss room almost at the start of the dungeon. But then the rest of the dungeon, after you unlock the boss chamber, where there's a gigantic Octorok, or rather a standard size Octorok, your miniature Link, in a block of ice, you then need to thaw out the room, and that's what actually activates it as a boss enemy.
I'd wondered if they did that because of the bait and switch from the wind element, because you realized that you couldn't get it, so it's almost just like, to keep your immersion in the game, they just show you the element right there and then, just like, oh, here's a water element, it's right in front of you, finally! But you still can't access it, but at least it's there.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's some really wild kind of sort of reversals of expectations in the middle of Minish Cap, where, yeah, there's the one dungeon where, in contrast to the Wind Waker, where there's a dungeon that was cut and you just receive the MacGuffin from an NPC after not having gone through the dungeon to get it. In this case, you do go through a dungeon to get the key MacGuffin in the Wind Temple, but the reward is not there. And so it's a sort of odd inversion of what happens in the Wind Waker. And then immediately after it is this odd inversion in the Temple of Droplets, where it inverts the normal kind of go through the dungeon, then find the boss order. Mm-hmm. Pretty neat.
Speaking of neat, this is my favorite boss in this whole game. The Gyorg pair.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure it's pronounced Gyorg, but I'm going to choose to pronounce it Georg because I think it's funnier.
You know, that's how I would say it. Yeah.
Wasn't that from Majora's Mask? Wasn't it the fish?
Thank you. It was driving me nuts because I was sure I'd seen that name before, but I couldn't place it because I couldn't think of another manta ray boss that we've covered.
Yeah, but no, it's a giant fish in the water temple, I believe.
Yeah, it's not mechanically or visually similar at all. It just has the same name.
Yeah, so essentially this boss takes the form of two flying manta rays up in the sky. One large red one and a smaller blue one. You start out riding on the back of the red Georg. In order to talk about this, we need to discuss the duplication mechanic briefly.
Oh yeah, gosh, yeah, we haven't addressed that, have we? That's a pretty key mechanic to this game.
Yeah, it's kind of a big one. as you get these elements from the dungeons and take them back to the temple, your sword gets infused with them, and on these kind of specific glowing tiles, you can charge up your sword and then move across these glowing tiles to kind of leave behind a duplicate of yourself that will move in tandem with you.
Yeah.
And if you move them through a wall or get hit by an enemy, they disappear. And there's a lot of puzzles based around this about creating duplicates of yourself in specific patterns to hit switches simultaneously, or needing to navigate, you know, lines of links across obstacles at the same time in order to get to like a big block at the end to push it.
Yeah.
In this case, you need to, there's these colored tiles on the back of the Georg, and different eyes will open on its back, and you need to dodge projectiles while making duplicates of yourself such that you can hit all the eyes that open simultaneously.
Yeah.
Once you've done that, the boss will kind of explode a little bit, and the blue one will swoop in, and you need to jump onto the back of the blue one, at which point it's a similar pattern. One eye will open at a time on the blue one, and you have to attack that while dodging its attempts to knock you off.
Yeah, it's so great. And then smaller enemies come flying through in sort of a bullet hell shooter style. They come flying across the arena, and you need to dodge them as well as the fight increases in intensity.
Yep. You do that a couple times, hopping back and forth between the blue and red one, with getting progressively more complex attacks that you need to dodge with... at this point, I think it's three of yourself?
Yes, yep. You have three links
three,
at this
yes.
point.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I thought this boss was extremely cool visually and just a lot of fun mechanically.
Yeah, it feels kind of like the fulfillment of what Capcom had been going for in Oracle of Seasons with their kind of their action-heavy boss encounters that they hadn't really been able to pull off in the engine of Link's Awakening, but were able to pull off here.
And the platforming is actually not... that frustrating.
No, it works.
Which is something that I honestly thought would like be a thing. Because the second like the rock's cape came into play, which is what you get in this dungeon, by the way.
Yeah, it lets you jump. Like, oh, yeah.
It lets you jump and actually glide.
True.
Or do a short amount of flight. I was just like, oh, good. Here we go. You know, a game that's not really built for platforming. Now they're introducing platforming. Time to die a lot.
Yeah.
But no, the platforming actually works really well. Because throughout the dungeon here, too, a lot of it is platforming, because you're in the Sky Temple, after all. When you're having to go between the backs of the red and blue one here and do enough damage, you're not going to have a lot of frustrating deaths, which is really nice. I'm really glad they put attention to detail.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I ever actually fell off of either of them, weirdly. You would really expect that to be a huge problem, but I guess they have enough generosity of the kind of the space that you land on and the timing of it that you're less likely to kind of fall off of the two bosses while you're fighting them.
It was my anti-lava, basically.
Yes, yeah.
Where I was magnetically drawn to lava.
I think I only fell off once. The first time the blue one did the tail whip attack, it kind of caught me off guard and I didn't jump over it in time. But yeah, never really fell off on accident when transitioning between the two.
Gosh, what a great fight.
It is.
It sure is. But now we're going to move on to Vaadi.
Yeah.
And I know we've been recording for a while, but I've got a lot to say about Vaadi here.
With good cause. Vaadi is a lot.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this is the final boss. It follows the unfortunate pattern of Link to the Past and the Oracle games, where up until this point, I felt the difficulty was very breezy.
Yeah.
And then it is a sharp spike in difficulty for the last boss for some reason. Vaadi himself is three phases with a timed run-up gauntlet, which is just as hard as the boss itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the first run-up to the boss, you run into a room where you hear a bell chime, and you are informed that once the bell chimes the third time, Vaadi will draw the light force from Zelda and become godlike in power. So you have to get to him before that happens. The first room is a very narrow pathway with an enemy called a ball and chain soldier. He just kind of whips a flail around at you. This is extremely annoying to avoid getting hit by on such a narrow platform. I found the best way was to just kind of spam ranged attacks, either in the form of a sword beam or bow and arrow at him to avoid getting hit. But it kind of feels like just a resource tax, either, you know, your time or your arrows or your health kind of getting through him.
Yeah, I just jumped through him, but you sustain damage that you aren't going to be able to recover necessarily.
Yeah. Then a large group of Keaton, which in this game are just kind of like these fox guys with knives that attack you and make you drop rupees. But then the third room. So let's talk about Dark Nuts. The watch is coming off here. At first, I loved the Dark Nut fight in this game, because they are large knights, sword and shield, and it plays out kind of like a very primitive, like I would say, Dark Souls fight.
Yeah.
They have a horizontal slash, which you can block with your shield, and then you have a brief opening to hit them back on their follow-through, and they have like straight stab attacks, which you can dodge laterally and then hit them in the side when they follow through on that attack. These openings aren't applicable to all of them because there are different color ones that have kind of different openings and more attacks. But in general, the lateral dodge on stab attacks, you can always hit. And on some of the weaker ones, you can Pegasus boot through them and then do a 180 and hit them in the back.
Oh, interesting. I never tried that.
These I found generally were fun fights. Later on in Dark Hyrule Castle, they will throw two of you at once, which I still found very manageable. But in this room where it throws three of them at you, the problem is they form almost a phalanx.
Yeah.
You'll be in a position where you have your shield out and you are blocking. And if one of them does the horizontal slash and you deflect it, it will push their model back enough that when you try to attack it back and hit it during the opening, your sword will bounce off the shield of one of the other two.
Yep.
And if they do the stab attack, if it's the one in the middle, it still doesn't work, because if you dodge to either side, then the Dark Knight on the left or right shield will still be in the way. Mm-hmm. So you have to just bide your time and wait for one of the ones that are grouped up on the side to do it. At which point, when you do that, it knocks them back, usually into kind of an L-shaped pattern, so that you're being boxed in by Dark Knights on two sides. And the arena is relatively small.
Right.
So a lot of times what I would find was when I would dodge the attack, I'd be kind of close to the side, hit it, it would knock it in that L shape, and I'd be boxed into a position where it would be very difficult for me to kind of get out without taking damage, and then get them to stack back up on top of one another so that I could try to rinse and repeat that.
Yeah, this whole encounter is just deliriously misguided. I only got through it through a combination of jumping and bombs.
It is not a fun fight, because for me, like, I didn't even try to jump over them. But kind of like the other fights that I mentioned, where you have a very small frame to attack them. Like, the first one was kind of annoying in the sense that just, like, you had to kind of gain an understanding as to, like, how much time you have to attack.
Yeah.
Before they put their shield up. But when you had, like, three of them here, even if I had two of them, if I was not careful, the first one would block my shot. Or would get hit, but the second one would block my shot.
Yeah.
And then the first one who got hit would end up attacking me, while the second one would end up attacking me right afterwards. And this just continuously happened every single time, because throughout the course of the fight, they also congregate to where you are.
Right. Yeah, exactly. They group up on one another, yeah.
Yeah, which ended up kind of hurting me, because at least in my case, I don't know about the rest of you, but like when they came around me, they boxed me in. Like, they didn't actually really get on top of each other, so to speak. They hold me in.
Yeah, it's just exhausting. It's boring and tiring to keep repeating the same boss again.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not a great challenge anymore. It's not this one thing that I'm trying to, like... It's not the Sephiroth in Kingdom Hearts 2 or 1 or whatever. It's just like... I die to the timer again.
Yeah, we're going... Well, I want to foreshadow something slightly, but there is an Eiji Aonuma philosophy of final bosses that we're going to get around to much later in the season. So, you know, listeners, look forward to that in, I want to say, Breath of the Wild is when we're going to cover it. But it addresses this issue in sort of an elegant way, and I think it runs directly contradictory to the kind of Capcom philosophy of boss fights, which is what you see in the Oracle games and here in Minish Cap.
The first phase of Vati proper, he kind of changes form into sort of like a wizard-looking thing with some eyes flying around him clockwise.
Mm-hmm.
If these eyes ram into Link, they damage him. Periodically, they will kind of stabilize and shoot lasers down toward the bottom of the screen and move and kind of pan left to right. And occasionally, Vati will teleport and will shoot kind of a homing black ball of energy at Link.
Mm-hmm.
What you want to do here is, while the eyes are flying around, you can slash them to destroy them. And once they're all destroyed, Vati becomes vulnerable to taking damage. Now, I screwed up the first two times I tried this boss, because the way it visually shows you that he's vulnerable is a big eye opens on his chest.
Uh-huh.
And Zelda has taught me that when an eye opens on a boss, to shoot it with the bow.
Darn right. Yep, that's what I did the first time, too.
Yeah, my first attempt at this, I was shooting him with the bow, and the bow does not do a lot of damage, and it shoots pretty slow, and it was such a miserable slog until, almost on accident, I found that you can hurt him with your sword.
Yeah, that's a really interesting error of visual language here. I don't know if that reflects... I mean, Capcom had already designed several Zelda games, so I don't want to say, like, Capcom didn't know the Zelda visual language, but that just flies in stark contrast to what you're told in any other Zelda game.
Yeah. At a certain point, after he takes enough damage, those flying eyes become protected by like a black force field that you remove with the gust jar.
Yeah.
Just kind of rinse repeat that until phase two, where he transforms into kind of like a big eye monster surrounded by these spheres. You want to shoot those spheres with your bow, and it will kind of cause them to flip over and turn either blue or red. You need to find the four spheres that turn red, because there are squares you use to duplicate in this arena.
Yeah.
And you need to create duplicates in the pattern such that you can go hit all red spheres around the boss simultaneously. After the second phase, you get kind of a false ending, where it looks like he's beaten, and it kind of drops you back in the castle.
Yeah.
Now, at this point, I had been pretty determined to not use save states or anything. I try to play these games in, like, the state they were originally released in. Mm-hmm. So, once I got to this point, though, it dropped me back in the castle, and as you move around, and there's, like, pots you can break that have more bombs and hearts mm-hmm. in them, I could smell the third phase coming.
Yeah.
And I just did... I did not have it in me to beat those dark nuts again. So I caved at this point, and I did make a save state after the second phase of that boss, going into phase three.
Having played this on the Wii U before and used the save states during this specific encounter for that very reason, I really miss them playing it on the 3DS this time.
At a certain point, Vadi pops back up for phase three. As we kind of described earlier, it's like a big bat-looking creature with one giant eye in the middle, except this time he's got two big floating shadowy arms. One at a time, he'll stick these arms into the ground and kind of submerge them, and then they'll pop up and attack. When they're in the ground like this, you can use the Cane of Pachi to flip it.
Yeah.
And then you enter Minish form and go inside the arm. Once inside, there's several flying eyes, which do damage you if they touch you. One will have a glowing red pupil. Attack that one to destroy it, and you kill the arm. You repeat this with the second arm, the one twist being the second arm is dark inside, so you have to have the flame lantern out to mm-hmm. see what you're doing when you go inside. Once both arms are destroyed, the boss will kind of spawn four smaller eyes in front of him, which will shoot energy balls at you. You need to make duplicates of Link to reflect four energy balls back simultaneously and hit all those eyes at the same time, at which point the boss is exposed to damage. Rinse, repeat that until the boss is dead and the game is won.
I came so close to losing during that last phase of the boss fight because it's so easy to throw one of those sort of energy balls off in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought this final boss was a huge hassle. I didn't like it. The one thing that I did like about it was that it really required you to make use of nearly every tool that you had in the game, which I thought was a neat, a neat way to kind of call back to each thing that you had done earlier.
I really liked the three stages of the boss. It's that just random enemy gauntlet you're forced to run through in between every attempt on the boss was too much.
It's so punishing.
If that hadn't have been there, the fact that this was three phases would not have bothered me probably at all.
Yeah.
It's just those things made it... One, if you didn't execute it well, it made you feel just too disadvantaged going into a three-phase fight.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you did execute it well, it's just too much of a time tax.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything particular in the dungeon section that we haven't already covered, Spencer, that you wanted to go into in some depth?
We've covered most of the dungeon notes kind of just tangentially through talking about the enemies and bosses and items. I did just want to mention one moment in the Cave of Flames that I loved. It actually got an audible laugh from me.
Uh-huh.
In the Cave of Flames, there is a part where you find a minecart, and Ezlo kind of stops and ridicules you for being scared to get in the minecart. And then when you get in the minecart, it takes off at a really unexpected speed.
Yes, it does. So fast.
And when it finally shoots you off the other end, I wrote this down, as Luke says, "Sweet jumping jellyfish, that was awful. I knew it was madness to risk our lives in that rickety human contraption."
Oh, that's good.
I loved that moment.
All right, so Hamilton, what did you think about this game?
I have very mixed feelings about this game in the sense that I actually really did like most of this game. And most people are just like, oh, was it that bad that you're saying I like most of it? Hear me out. So the game itself is a very solid, it's a very solid game in the Legend of Zelda series. I've never felt like super frustrated by it. Like, I loved the dynamics of this game. I loved the sprite work of this game. Again, when you're working with a game with very limited, like, audio from characters in terms of, like, what they say, to be able to kind of create a game that expresses their personality through their artwork is very interesting to me. I like things that bring out the character and personality in people. Mm-hmm. So to that end, this game was very, very interesting. There wasn't a whole lot of story, but I mean, that's not going to chase me away from a game per se.
Like Mario and Sonic don't have a lot of story, but they're pretty engaging.
Exactly. They're not made for it, but they're still, you know, very solid games. The gameplay of this game is very fun. The dungeons are very well done. It still makes you think. Do I wish there's a bit more hints as to complete it? Perhaps. Does it take away from the gameplay, or like how much you're enjoying the game? No. So for me, going back to previous installments of the games that we played before, like Link to the Past and Oracle of Ages, my biggest concern? The biggest complication, I suppose, I had sometimes was the fact that you can only use two items at a time, in the sense that when you go to their main menu, you can equip two items. So let's say you just want your sword and your shield. Great. So you equip your sword to B and your shield to A. Fine. But now you have access to nothing else. And there are certain parts of dungeons or certain parts of your adventure where you need to kind of use multiple items, even between screens.
Yes.
Like, there might be one screen where you need to use... I'm sorry, what's it called? The gust jar. And there are other ones where you need to use the staff. But that's in between frames. Yeah. And there's also... Consider that there's probably enemies in between these two frames as well. And the enemies may not be able to be defeated by the two things. Like, for instance, there's a buzzing enemy, like a helicopter enemy, and I forgot what the name of it
is. Is that the P-Hat?
I think it's the P-Hat.
Yeah, my nemesis.
You need to use the gust jar to defeat it. But let's say in the previous, you needed to use the staff. So you're thinking, oh, okay, I'll switch over to the staff. I'm fine, right? So you go to the next thing. But the second you hit that next panel, there's a bunch of P-hats that are surrounding you and instantly attacking you. So your first instinct is, oh, I need to defend myself. You use your sword. Well, your sword's ineffective. So you take hits because the sword, like, knocks them away, but it keeps going into your face. So, darn it, you switch to the gust jar, you defeat them, and then you go to the next one, and then you realize, oh, I need the rock cape, or something of that nature. I'm not using very specific examples, but it's something of that nature, and things like that kind of ruin the immersion for me, because I'm trying to, like, go through the adventure, and then all of a sudden I completely enter a thing or just like, oh, I need a different item, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I just personally don't like to hit pause, go to that next item, get that item, go back to the thing, defeat the enemy, go back to the start menu, change out my thing again, go back to the thing, go to the next panel, and then go back to the start menu again to change it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and that problem grows a bit as the game goes on. As much as I like portions of the game that require you to make use of a wide range of tools, because I think it's a... You know, it's a pretty cool way to integrate earlier mechanics and iterate on them.
Mm-hmm.
The more that happens in a game that only has two face buttons for tools, the more time you may be spending in the pause menu, which certainly sunk at least portions of Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons.
But again, even though that kind of ruins my own immersion, it didn't really take away from the game. It is fun. It is a great game, and I still recommend people playing it. That was just kind of my gripe. That's all.
Yeah, and it's kind of a bummer to see that the shoulder buttons could have been used to alleviate the problems that portable Zelda games had already encountered, but weren't. It's something of a missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
As far as my impressions of the game, I liked it even more this time than the previous time that I had played it. I tend to think that the Minish Cap has something of a diminished reputation compared to its, its quality overall. I think this is effectively the fulfillment of what had been attempted with Link's Awakening, with Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons.
Agreed.
It lacks the sort of sense of place of Link's Awakening. Link's Awakening had a very specific kind of character with Koholint Island and the very sort of dreamscape style approach to world building. It lacks some of the mechanical ambition of Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons, in that you don't have, say, four different world states like you did in Oracle of Seasons, or a pretty radically different past and present as you did in Oracle of Ages. What results from stripping away a lot of that stuff around the edges is what I think is probably the most mechanically satisfying 2D Legend of Zelda game outside of Link to the Past and Link Between Worlds. The sprite work certainly does a lot to bring you in. I think this sprite work is... I hope I don't disappoint anybody listening. I think this sprite work is the best sprite work of the Legend of Zelda series. I think it is heads above Link to the Past, just due to how extraordinarily expressive it is. And Link to the Past is already a gorgeous game. I will say a couple things that disappointed me about it. The hint system in this I find pretty irritating, in that Eslo will sometimes offer hints to solve puzzles that you haven't had the chance to, sort through yourself. Which is a real pet peeve of mine. I want to be able to solve something at my own pace, not be kind of, beaten around the head about, here's how you solve it. Why haven't you solved it yet? Like, it's a puzzle, for Pete's sake. Let me experiment a bit. But then alternately, Eslo will not give key hints that direct you to where you need to go at times. Even if you tap the select button, the hint will be something very ambiguous. And may well, the library sequence is a good one, where Eslo keeps directing the player to the library, which is meaningless if the player hasn't figured out that Link needs to flip over jars using the Cane of Pachi. And certainly the final boss sequence is a disappointing note to end an otherwise pretty great game on. I think it skews a little too easy at times, particularly for the first half. I think its difficulty is best balanced during the middle portion of the game and in the final couple of dungeons, which are excellent. But then it really falls apart a bit in the final boss and the gauntlet leading up to it. Those are my impressions on Minish Cap. How about you, Spencer?
I loved like 95% of this game.
Yeah.
Aesthetically, as we've said a bunch, the sprite work is beyond reproach in this. It is really gorgeous. I recall in the Oracle of games, I criticized the soundtrack a little bit for being boring when it wasn't a rearrangement of a classic Zelda tune.
Yeah.
I think the music is much better in this one. Capcom did a pretty good job. The difficulty, right up until that final boss gauntlet is pretty spot on. I thought it kind of curved well. Some of the puzzles in the Temple of Droplets in particular I really liked.
Yeah, absolutely.
The rewards for exploration, I thought, were pretty good. I found it pretty easy and intuitive to find a lot of pieces of heart. At the beginning of the game, at least, when I went out of my way to kind of poke at the corners, I was always happy by what I found. That curve didn't stay perfect the whole time. By the end of the game, I was definitely so flush with rupees and extra kinstones that when I found a giant ruby or more kinstones, I was kind of disappointed by it.
Yeah.
But in general, it keeps that pace well. It's got a good sense of character. I think this is the best feeling combat in any 2D Zelda game.
Yeah, agreed.
you know, only having the two items equipped at a time didn't bother me as much. It seemed to me that there was some design consideration given to reducing the amount of menuing you did. Capcom's previous attempts at this, you know, there were some pretty egregious examples of having to constantly switch back and forth items that I didn't really run into as much here.
Yeah, that one boss where really the underlying boss was the menu.
The only real mar against it that I have any, you know, significant complaints about is just that last little stretch, which is upsetting because, again, I think the actual boss design of Vadi itself is pretty nice. It's just, it felt like an arbitrary decision to throw a bunch of extra enemies at you just to try to inflate the difficulty of the fight.
Yeah.
And I don't think I don't think that was additive to the experience at all.
Yeah, I agree entirely. This would be, famously, at least at the time of recording, the last traditional 2D Zelda game ever created. There would be a handful of 2.5D Zelda games that came after this, and we're certainly going to be talking about them, as well as some spin-offs that came out around the same time that were similarly 2D. But as far as the pure chronology, there would never again be a sprite-based 2D Zelda game, just a straight-up top-down Zelda in the style of what the series had been in its earliest entries. So happily, Capcom sent it off in style. Next time on Franchise Festival, we're going to be covering the multiplayer spin-offs of the early 2000s, including The Four Swords, which was packed in alongside the GBA's Link to the Past port, as well as Four Swords Adventure, which was a full-fat multiplayer Legend of Zelda spin-off designed from the ground up for the Nintendo GameCube. If you would like to check out our show notes or find articles on other video game series history, you can visit our website at franchisefestivalpodcast.com. You can also leave us comments there, let us know what you liked or didn't like about the show, and we will certainly take those into consideration for future episodes. Until next time, this has been your hosts, Christian.
And I'm Hamilton.
And I'm Spencer.
And we were really happy to have you with us as we discussed The Legend of Zelda, The Minish Cap. Thanks for listening, folks. Goodbye.